Chapter 3. Raiding the Garden. Kruger Stoneshield gave a great yawn and tried to rub the cobwebs of sleep from his weary eyes. He stood on a small ledge in a tiny alcove, peering through a long tube that poked through the side of the mountain called Fourth Peak, which housed his homeland of Mithril Hall. A few days before, Kruger had seen the dragon flying around. The huge white wing had flashed right before his startled eyes. It was his report that had explained the sudden troubles with several of the chimneys down in the Undercity. Since that time, though, the view had been as settled as the winter snows. Kruger reminded himself to be vigilant. His people were counting on him. King Conrad was counting on him. King Brunner was counting on him. "Aye, King Brunner," he mumbled, gathering up the end of the spyglass and lifting it to his eye. King Brunner was back, and wouldn't them orcs be a sorry lot afore long? That thought brought a grin and chuckle to Kruger. He imagined a swarm of orcs in full flight in front of the dwarven brigades. He wanted to be on those front lines, chasing the pig-faced dogs all the way back to their holes in the spine of the world. He got his visual bearings when he noted the southern rim of Keeper's Dale through the spyglass, the high sun gleaming brilliantly off the long icicles jabbing down from the ledges. Like dragon's teeth, he thought. He stood up taller, lifting the back end of the hanging scope, moving his line of sight down, down into the bowl and the vast orc encampment therein. For a moment he noted the activity superficially, hardly registering the many movements of the small dark forms around the new-fallen snow. For a moment he just figured that the orcs were clearing off their tents and weapons racks and such from the foot of snow that had fallen the night before. But as the patterns began to truly register, Kruger's eye popped open wide, and he even pulled back from the spyglass and rubbed that orb again, trying to make sense out of what he had just seen. He went right back to the scope and began moving it methodically around the vast encampment. And then he knew. There could be no doubt, particularly given the already long train exiting the western side of Keeper's Dale. The orcs were leaving. Hands trembling, Kruger slid his field of vision over to the northern end of the dale, then climbed up the north wall. His breath fell away when he saw the partially deconstructed catapults and ballistae. The giants, too, were pulling back. Had this last snowstorm broken the siege at long last? Had events in other parts of the Silver Marches, about Felbar or Silvery Moon, perhaps, demanded reinforcements? Almost giddy with anticipation, Kruger Stoneshield hooked his boot on the metal pole on the outside of the ladder. Like all of Mithril Hall's mountain scouts, he wore shoes with a semicircular spur made of strong mithril that he could clip onto the ladder, one side and the other, so he could slide down the 30 feet to the lower chamber, the reporting chamber, as it was called, a chamber designed for messages and set with a desk, inkwell, parchment, and smooth-scroll tubes. One wall was fitted with a long pipe that wound down to sentries and deeper caverns still. A scout could write a report, stuff it into a scroll tube, and send it sliding down to the waiting hands below. With a quick last look at the giants and another scan at the departing orcs and goblins along the valley floor, Kruger let go of the spyglass and bent low to grab the ladder, clipping his second boot in place as he did. He almost began his swift descent, but only then did the last image of the frost giants truly register to him. Many of the war machines were already dismantled, or nearly so, but the last group. Were they taking apart that huge catapult? Or turning it? Kruger scrambled back up and grabbed the spyglass, twisting it around until he locked in once more on the group in question. "Turning it?" he asked, then added, "Loading it?" He licked his dry lips, he stroked his beard, but he didn't blink or pull back from the spyglass over the next few heartbeats, as a large load of burning pitch went into the catapult basket. The great and powerful behemoths began to crank mightily, bending back that arm. "What in the nine hells are you shooting at?" the dwarf whispered. There were no targets out there. The dragon, perhaps? He couldn't hear the release immediately from this great distance, and so the spreading load of flaming pitch was speeding toward him by the time the creak and whoosh of the great beam reached his ears. Kruger squinted and had to fight hard to resist the urge to duck away as the pitch came flying in. He felt the tremor as if hit, higher up on the mountain than his scouting position. Perhaps it was the dragon up there, and wouldn't it be grand to see the giants get into a tussle with a white worm? He heard no dragon roar, however, and the giants, standing around the catapult and, along with many of their kin, shielding their eyes from the high sun and staring up at Fourth Peak, did not seem concerned. Then the rumble began, deeper and more resonant than the impact. And so it built, and was then 1,000 times louder, and the chamber and the mountain began to tremble violently. Kruger's vision was stolen by a great darkness, and he could feel the power as tons of snow swept down past him from on high. An avalanche! The giants had set off an avalanche! Now he understood. They were indeed leaving, and closing Mithril Hall's door with a mountain of snow behind them. Kruger got a few quick glances as the snow plummeted all around him, and he scrambled up as high as he could go, taking his field of vision back into the dale, all the way down to the east, to the mountain door of Mithril Hall. Or at least, to where he would have expected that door to be had it not been buried under the avalanche. Then he could see no more as the snow settled, leaving a thick cap above the hole at the other end of the spyglass. Kruger's stone shield was on the ladder in a heartbeat, sliding down so fast that he was practically falling free, so eager was he to report this startling turn of events. "They must have needed him elsewhere," Brunner said when the report filtered down to the throne room, where King Conrad sat with the former king and both sets of their principal advisors. Brunner looked to Drizzt and shrugged. "Felbar breaking out, perhaps?" the drow offered. "Scouts in the East Perches ain't reporting no movement by the Cerberan Bridge," King Conrad said. "The orcs would be crossing the bridge if they're meaning to get to Felbar."
"Silvery Moon, then," said General Dagnabbit. "Might be that they're not waiting for the spring melt."
"Or they are baiting us," Catty Bree cautioned.
"Won't be smart, then," the fierce bungalow thump was quick to interject. "Bah, but if they're letting us out in the open, where we can put into squares and such, we'll roll them into the red snow."
"They knocked the mountain over the derned door,"
General Dagnabbit reminded him.
"Bah, but that's not to stop us from getting out," Thump replied. "I'll dig it meself, or me boys, aye me boys. We'll run them in one after another, head down and helmet spike leading, and drill a tunnel to Keeper's Dale afore the hour's through. Ye just give me the nod, me king."
The way he said, "me king," took Brunner's breath away, so reminiscent was it of Brunner's old friend Puent, and full of the same passion and loyalty. Looking at Bungalow Thump only reinforced to Brunner that he had taken the correct course in not challenging Conrad for Mithril Hall's throne. Conrad had built something here as fine as Brunner's time in the hall. Brunner couldn't help but smile. That had been his fondest hope when he'd turned his kingdom over to Beinak Braunanvil that century before. This was the constancy of dwarven culture that so aligned with a sense of order and discipline that had kept their kingdom so strong through the centuries. In dwarven culture, no one was irreplaceable, and so the fall of a king, no matter how beloved, did not incite fears for the future. The replacement had been properly selected and groomed. That thought led Brunner to look to Conrad's right, to General Dagnabbit, and to wonder if, should Conrad fall in the war, Mithril Hall might be crowning her first queen. "And I," Brunner thought with an approving nod, though Dagnabbit, who noticed it, could only respond with a curious expression. That would prove to be a fine choice.
"If they've gone to Silvery Moon, the sooner we're out, the better," King Conrad remarked.
"Aye," Brunner agreed. "Out and around to take the bridge."
"So we allow them to assault Silvery Moon while we try to free Citadel Felbar?" Drizzt asked. Every dwarf in the room nodded emphatically. When Brunner ended, though, he realized that the instinctual reaction told him a lot about the state of the alliance known as Lorwar. Or perhaps he should think of it as the former alliance.
"Ye never go in through the gate," Brunner said to Drizzt and Catti Bree as they crawled along the newly constructed tunnel. "Farmers are always watching the gate. Plumpest mushrooms are off to the side."
He gave an exaggerated wink, clearly enjoying King Conrad's decision to break out of Mithril Hall.
"Aye, ye send the little one to the gate, but not through, to keep the farmer's attention, don't ye know, ye silly drow?"
Catti Bree added in her best Brunner imitation, and that brought a smile to the faces of all three. When Conrad made his choice, he turned to Brunner for help, and why wouldn't he? No dwarf in the Silver Marches had a better battle reputation than Brunner Battlehammer, and it was one honestly earned.
"If we're going out, then get out fast," Brunner advised. "But raid the garden and stay away from the gate."
That last analogy provided the humor in the small and new tunnel that day. By raiding the garden, Brunner referred to a game all young dwarves played, a cat-and-mouse tradition with the farmers of Mithril Hall or of Icewind Dale or anywhere else dwarves of Clan Battlehammer had called home. The thought was to create a subtle diversion, in this case by setting dwarves near the Keeper's Dale exit from Mithril Hall with hammers and picks enough to make a bit of noise, a bit of a stir outside the halls. But nothing so compelling or loud as to suggest any immediate breakout. Indeed, other clans' dwarves were also creeping out of higher tunnels to the avalanche pack, poking and prodding and freeing boulders to tumble down over the door, in an effort to give any scouts or magical eyes the orcs might have left in place the impression that the avalanche was doing its job and keeping the exit sealed. In the meantime, the real garden raiders had dug another way out, one that would put them up on the ridge where the giants had been. The orcs were still camped on the other two main exits, the northern and eastern doors. But if Conrad could get a strong enough force out quietly on the northern edge of Keeper's Dale, they could swing around and clobber the force in the north. With that wide door cleared, Mithril Hall could overwhelm the orc force by the Cerberin in short order, before orc reinforcements could begin to arrive. It was a desperate plan, to be sure, with so many orc armies marching around. But not one of the advisers to King Conrad had argued against it. The three companions came into a wide round chamber, a natural cave that had been found along the route, and was now full of busy dwarves. There was a side passage off to their right, curling back into the mountain, but the new tunnel was being dug directly across the way, directly across a frozen underground pond. As the trio neared the closest bank, Drizzt looked at the new dig, trying to sort out the somewhat confusing details as the dwarves skated back and forth across the ice, many carrying buckets, other hauling bundles of great shields all strapped together. Also, the tunnel being dug now was not level, not even gently sloping, but rose at a fairly steep angle, perhaps 30 or 40 degrees. The drow looked to Catti Bree, who seemed as perplexed as he, and shrugged.
"You don't raid the garden without a fast flight."
Brunner, who was not surprised and indeed had helped organize all of this, told them with a wink. He led them across the lake slowly, pointing out the double tunnel being built. One side was being dug simply, natural stone and ground chopped into stairs, while the other, cut on the other side of a small ridge, was simply a slope, and one the dwarves were smoothing out carefully, even sliding sections of flat rock into place to cover jagged expanses.
150 feet more to the ridge north of Keeper's Dale," Brunner explained. "Tunnel's more than halfway there, and we're finding easier ground now."
A crash turned them all around to see a gang of dwarves entering the chamber from the side tunnel, pulling a wagon loaded with firewood and coal and piles of heavy blankets.
"Over there!"
Brunner ordered, pointing to the corner back where he and the other two had entered, a small area mostly secluded by large stalagmites.
"And you got the curving beams!"
"Aye, King Brunner!"
one shouted back, her smile so wide that it almost took in her ears. She clapped her hands and shouted, "Whee!" and all the dwarves around her began to laugh. Should we even ask? Driz said to Brunner.
Nah,
replied the dwarf, who was clearly quite elated at getting out into the fight.
You're not wanting to know.
Off to the side of the trio, an excited young dwarf went running up to King Conrad, prompting the three to silence so they could hear the news.
We're to the snow, the youngster announced to the king. And she's not thick about our hole. We're out, me king.
Conrad looked over at Brunner and nodded. They had already agreed that Drizzt would be among the first out of the hole so that he could scout around. Caddybreed turned to the drow and began spellcasting. A few moments later, a profound warmth spread throughout Drizzt's body.
To protect you from the winter winds, she said.
Drizzt merely smiled and kissed her lightly on the cheek. He had survived scores of winters in Icewind Dale, out on the mountainside or open tundra around 10 towns, and surely was no stranger to the winter winds. He gave her a wink, though, for surely he appreciated the gesture. With Brunner and Caddybree beside him, Drizzt moved to the upsloping tunnel where Bungalow Thump and several others of the famed Gutbuster Brigade waited.
"Ye go out right behind me, Self-Elf!" the ferocious dwarf said.
Bungalow moved to the tunnel stair and took a great shield off the stack.
"And don't ye forget to get yourself a shield!" he called back to Drizzt. "I fight with 2 weapons," Drizzt replied, moving up.
Bungalow laughed at him.
"Take a shield," he said. "You'll put it down when ye get out, but we're needing 'em up there."
Drizzt did as he was asked, and off they went up the long stairway. When they reached the top, Bungalow Thump looked back, grinned, then plowed right through into the open air atop the ridgeline framing the northern end of Keeper's Dale. The wind howled in their ears, and it was a cold one indeed, late in the afternoon, with the meager sun already touching the western horizon. But other than the blowing snow, nothing stirred around them. Despite the whiteness of the snow and the fact that they had been underground for months, they did not need to squint. The sky above remained dark, still in the grasp of the foul drow magic. Bungalow tossed his shield to the snow, which was not deep in this wind-blown place on the far side of the tunnel exit, and nodded for Drizzt to stack his atop it. Drizzt complied, still not quite understanding, and before he had even put the shield down, he was crowded by the other gutbusters, rushing from the tunnel and eager to be rid of their great shields.
"Now don't ye be worrying about taking back your own if it's time to get back in," Bungalow Thump explained. "You just grab the top one on the pile and take your ride, ha!"
Drizzt looked from the shield pile, and already it was considerable, to the tunnel exit just as Caddybree came out, Brunner close behind and Athrogate close behind him, and all three carrying shields.
"You cannot mean..."
Drizzt replied to Bungalow Thump, and the dwarf howled and bounded away.
"What?"
Caddybree asked, coming over to place her shield on the stack. Drizzt looked past her to note that some of the dwarves now coming out carried buckets of water, which they carefully poured back into the tunnel along the smooth side and not the stairs. The gutbusters were already forming a wide defensive perimeter around the exit, but there was no sign of any enemies. Even out from the sheltering mountainside, the snow was not too deep, though visibility was fairly low from the constant swirls of blowing snow and the lack of normal daylight. Brunner tapped Drizzt on the arm and pointed up to a rocky ridge in the northeast.
"Light's getting low, Elf. And weren't much to start with in this darkened land. You think you can get up there?"
Drizzt nodded.
"You'll see the orc camp up by the north door from there," Brunner explained. "I'm wanting to be hitting them soon as the dark settle deep. We'll get around the mountain and to the Cerberin by mid-morning if the weather holds."
"Might be enemies hiding in the cracks around the rocks," Caddybree pointed out.
Drizzt nodded and smiled at her.
"Bring your boys to the base," he instructed Brunner.
Then he trotted off toward the ridge, through the growing throng of battlehammers exiting the tunnel and stretching in the open air for the first time in many 10 days. As soon as he passed beyond the widening gutbuster perimeter, he paused, and when he started off once more,
Gwenifar now beside him. He heard the muted claps and cheers and even gasps from the dwarves behind them. Only a few of them had seen the magnificent panther, of course, and even those who had known the cat before, other than the handful who had been in the lower tunnel when Drizzt and his companions had first come into Mithril Hall, hadn't seen her in decades. Gwenivar led the way to the rocky outcropping, bounding along the icy stones with sure-footed ease. Propelled by his magical ankle bracelets and graced with exceptional agility, even for one of his dexterous race, Drizzt too went up gracefully and swiftly. With the hunting panther leading the way, he was confident that no monsters would spring out at him from concealed cubbyholes. Stone to stone he leaped, and still the dwarves gathered below, a sizable crowd now, and with more still pouring out of Mithril Hall. From Drizzt's high vantage, they seemed more a teeming and amorphous mass than individual figures. The drow had to slow as he got higher. Snow remained thick around the stones, and with ice settled firmly beneath it. He glanced back just before he crested the ridge. Several hundred dwarves were out now, their perimeter widening. Looking past them into Keeper's Dale, off to the west farther along the rim, or even up north to the wide passes, Drizzt could see no sign of enemies, other than the tracks left by the giants and their departing war machines. The fact that those tracks went north, however, did set off an alarm, or at least a series of concerning questions. If the besieging giants had gone off to reinforce the main Many Arrows army, their ultimate direction would be either south to Silvery Moon or Everlund, or east to the Cerbrin Bridge and the road to Citadel Felbar. Why were they going north? The fastest and easiest trail to the south would have taken them straight west around Keeper's Dale, and if the Cerbrin Bridge was their goal, they should have passed just north of this very ridge Drizzt now stood upon. Those questions drove him upward even faster, his eagerness bringing him over the ridge and in view of the northern door, where the orc forces remained encamped. Exactly as they had hoped, Drizzt thought with a nod. But he glanced again back to the north, where the snow had been cleaved by the wheels of huge war engines. Had the giants abandoned the orcs, he wondered? He thought back to the time of King Obuld. That same alliance had been tenuous indeed. With that in mind, he focused more intently on the orc camp, and immediately began to see the troubling signs that this was not as it seemed. The orcs milled around their cook fires and bonfires, seemingly going about their late-day routine, at a casual glance. But they all had their weapons, Drizzt noted, even heavy halberds and great axes, and many had their swords in hand, empty scabbards hanging on their belts. The dwarves wouldn't ambush them. Drizzt spun and called the panther to his side. "Gwen, down as fast as you can and right back into Mithril Hall," he instructed the cat, who gave a low growl and leaped away. Drizzt started down at full speed, but the panther flew a dozen of his strides with each powerful leap. She hit one snow-capped rock, and the whole thing began to tip, and for a moment Drizzt held his breath. But Gwenivar was gone before the stone could roll around upon her, flying through the air to a snowy expanse, then riding a miniature avalanche all the way to the ground. Brunner, Catibri, and the other dwarves noted the cat's run long before that last snowy slide. They saw Drizzt, too, far above and rushing down.
"He's seen something," Athrogate remarked. "Aye, and wanting us to be on the move," Brunner replied.
"A charge or a retreat?" Catibri asked.
Just to the east of them, at the base of the rocky outcropping, Gwenivar came rolling down in a cloud of snow. The black ball of snarling feline came out of that frozen tangle at full speed, rushing for the friends.
"We're to know soon," Brunner remarked.
He braced himself, expecting the cat to run him over and sit on him, as had happened so many times in his previous life. But Gwenivar didn't slow, didn't acknowledge the trio at all as she sped by, other than a quick snarl in their direction. She raced off of the tunnel back into Mithril Hall, the dwarves there scattered as she neared, and went straight back into the hole.
"Retreat," Catibri mouthed, realizing the signal. We've been lured.
Conrad!
Brunner yelled, and started running for the young king, waving his arms, though Conrad had surely noted the panther's run as well. Caddybree's attention went back to the rocky ridge and Drizzt, still picking his way down with all speed.
What did you see, my love?
She whispered under her breath, her eye roving back up to the crest of the mountain spur, as if she expected a horde of giants to come bounding into sight at any moment. When nothing appeared, she continued her upward movement, her gaze climbing the mountainside, looking for monsters, looking for some hint. And there she saw the white dragon, above the high top of Fourth Peak and dropping from on high, and the sight took her breath away. Beside her, Brunner heard that gasp and followed the shocked woman's gaze.
Elf! He screamed, running for the ridge and banging his axe on his shield. Elf! Dragon!
The wind had kicked up, moaning about the stones, and Drizzt was still far away, so even when Caddybree joined in the shouting, Brunner and she doubted he could hear them. But he did notice the dragon, and the worm had surely taken notice of him. Drizzt veered to a high stone, the dragon closing, and now Brunner and Caddybree noted a drow riding the worm. Out Drizzt leaped just an instant before the dragon leveled out, huge wings battling its own momentum, and cut fast to the side. It soared past the rock as Drizzt fell far below. The ranger hit the snow hard and fell back into it, riding down a small avalanche into another jag of stone.
"Crossbows! Shoot the damned thing!"
Athrogate roared, the dragon already turning and coming back in at Drizzt. But other cries from the north sounded as well. An army of orcs and giants had appeared, coming around a second rocky spur and charging at the dwarves with all speed.
"To the hall, girl!"
Brunner ordered Caddybree, but he cut the thought short as he turned to find Caddybree standing calm, her eyes closed, beginning the chant of a spell.
"To the hall, all of us!"
King Conrad corrected, running with his entourage to join Brunner.
"We're not fighting a horde of orcs and giants with that beast flying about."
Conrad grabbed Brunner by the shoulder, but Brunner wouldn't budge and wouldn't look away. Up above, Drizzt came back into sight, scrambling upon a high rock, Tolmeril now in hand as he leveled toward the incoming dragon. The beast flew fast along the mountainside, weaving back and forth, not so much out of fear for the bow as trying to protect its rider. A streak of silver flew past it, then a second. A third scored a stinging hit on the dragon's shoulder, but the beast didn't slow. Up on the rock, Drizzt moved to the end as if to leap again, and Brunner cried out in warning. The dragon swerved outward from the mountain spur and probably would have caught him in its mouth if he'd followed that course. Drizzt's leap was a feint, though, and he reversed suddenly and leaped back the other way, deeper into the rocks. But the dragon was ready for that, too, and its serpentine neck rolled back at the rocks, and from its open maw came a thick blast of freezing breath, chasing Drizzt back right behind him, following him down and surely catching him just beyond Brunner's view.
"Elf!"
the dwarf howled, and Conrad and Dagnabbit joined in. The dragon swooped past the point, wings wide and turning as it tried to slow. A fireball caught it there in midair, some 50 feet or so past where Drizzt had disappeared. The beast came through the flames awkwardly, with its wings tucked defensively and turning and rocking, too close to the stones. On its back, the drow crouched low, a translucent shield defensively up over his head.
"Oh, good shot, girl!"
Conrad yelled as the dragon clipped the stones and began to tumble, rolling past, finally kicking out but dropping down below the ridge and into Keeper's Dale.
"To the hall," Conrad demanded, and he started that way, dragging a reluctant Brunner.
Over by the tunnel, the dwarves were already in retreat methodically. They went to the stacks of shields in a line, taking one and diving atop it into the smooth, iced side of the tunnel, riding it back into the tunnels. A fight was on, though, up in the north, as the leading lines of orcs met with the gutbusters, and it wasn't one Brunner intended to miss. Brunner shoved Conrad hard toward the tunnel. The younger dwarf caught his balance and swung back, surprised and snarling.
"You're the king!" Brunner yelled at him. "Get yourself in!"
"Aye, and yourself's Brunner,"
Dagnabbit said, grabbing at the red-bearded dwarf who tugged away from her.
"Get yourself in!"
"Aye, I'm Brunner, with no throne under me, bum, and know that I'm seeing me place," Brunner explained.
He charged off to the north, Caddybree and Athrogate right behind.
Only Atherogate ran full out to join in the fighting, though, as Catibri and Brunner continued to stare up the ridge for some sign of their friend, hoping against hope. Arothiter veered back and forth as he approached the drow, those stinging lightning arrows reaching out far too quickly for the worm's liking. Tiago, his magnificent shield in front of him, easily blocking any of the shots, cared less, much less. This was Drizzt standing on that rock. Drizzt the heretic. Drizzt the embarrassment. Drizzt the trophy. Out went the rogue drow, as if to leap away down the rock face, and Arothiter veered out, but back went Drizzt, diving into the stones. The dragon couldn't turn his bulk or slow, but he could and did swivel his head, and Tiago lifted his sword in victory. From his perch he could see the dragon's killing breath catching up to the rogue drow in the rocky crevice. And then the drow pulled back and curled inward. Arothiter howled in protest as a fireball erupted immediately in front of them. A tremendous blast seared and expanded as the pair crashed right through. Tiago got as small as he could behind his shield, but still the flames caught him and bit at him. The dragon rolled, and Tiago nearly fell free. The dragon clipped the rocky outcropping, dislodging stones and throwing snow, and one of Tiago's legs came free in the awkward impact. Finally, Arothiter managed to right himself enough to push off from the cliff, but in a tumble and roll, right over, spinning down over the lip of the gorge. Somehow Tiago held his seat, but at the price of his sword, which went flying free into the blowing snow, tumbling into the wide canyon known as Keeper's Dale. Tiago shouted, but it was more a growl than any meaningful word as the drow struggled to hold on, as the dragon too plummeted into the vale. At the last moment, Arothiter managed to right himself and collect his wits enough to spread his wings, but still down they went, skidding and crashing into the deep snow in the bowl of Keeper's Dale. Tiago lay in the snow, his legs aching, and one, he was sure, was broken. His skin stung from those flames. He could hardly believe the power of that fireball. When he located Arothiter in the dying light, he expected that the dragon shared his feelings. Smoke wafted from the worm's horned head, and even in the last moments of daylight, meager as it was, Arothiter's face seemed to glow, radiating heat. The dragon just growled long and low, and Tiago half expected the thing to eat him. "My sword," he said, grimacing as he struggled to sit up. "We must find it."
"Your sword, drow?" Arothiter roared at him. "An army up above, and I will find and eat that wizard, and do you fret for a sword?"
"The Drenath," Tiago argued. "Not just a sword, an artifact of the New Age, crafted by Golfanon in the Forge of Gontalgrim." The dragon's growl seemed more a purr suddenly.
"Do tell," the beast prompted.
"You cannot have it," Tiago said flatly. "You will invite the wrath of all of Menzo Berenzon. I must find my—" He tried to stand, but a wave of agony burned up his leg and he nearly swooned.
"I will find your sword, drow," the dragon promised. "And you will reward me handsomely for it, and for killing that rogue drow."
Tiago settled back, suddenly contented. Yes, of course the dragon would find it. Could such a treasure remain hidden from a dragon as mighty as Arothiter? And yes, they were in no hurry. Drizzt was surely dead, frozen in a tumble of rocks far from any of his friends. They could go up and cut him out at their leisure, likely. The orcs and giants would chase the dwarves back into their hole. The drow packed his aching leg in snow. His wife would fix it. Perhaps there was a benefit of being married to a high priestess after all, even if that priestess was the wretched Sarabel Zorlaren. He saw the crevice and leaped for it. He had to get inside and around a bend, something, anything, to get out of the path of the dragon's killing breath. But he couldn't make it. He knew that halfway through his leap from the rock. He did get into the crevice, part of the way at least, but there was no depth to it, and no turn that would move him away from the cloud of frost that caught him there and filled the area. Drizzt instinctively curled his cloak around him, but warm though it was, he knew in his mind that it could not protect him from such a lethal weapon as the breath of an ancient white dragon. And he felt those cold tendrils now reaching for him, licking at him. Reflexively, he curled and held his breath, and a great lament washed over him with a thought that he would never see his friends again, that he would never hold Catti Bree again. He felt himself tightening to the stone as the frosty dragon breath settled over him, cocooning him, icing him in place. The press was great, the ice against his face and hands, exposed skin caught in the blast. But it didn't hurt, and though he felt the chill, it was not a deathly thing, not a cold that went to his bones and settled there, stealing his very life force. No, far from it. Indeed, the weight of the press was more uncomfortable than the chill of the ice. The ice wasn't biting him at all. He thought of his sword icing death, but that was a blade to protect from flames, not from cold. Not understanding, but having more pressing needs at that moment, Drizzt braced himself against the stone and pushed out with all his strength. He heard the ice crackling all around him, but the press remained. Again and again he pushed against the frozen tomb, cracking it, weakening it bit by bit. Finally it came free of the rock with a great swooshing sound. Drizzt staggered and nearly toppled as some fell away, but a large chunk remained stuck fast, frozen to his forest green cloak. Still he felt no cold bite as he pushed the flecks from his bare arms and hand and face and neck. And still he could not comprehend how he had so completely ignored the killing breath of the dragon. And then it hit him, as he recalled his last moments in the cave below the tunnel, when Catti Bree had come up to him and cast an enchantment upon him to protect him from winter's bite.
"Good spell, my wife," Drizzt muttered through teeth that were not chattering.
He worked more quickly then, reminding himself that a white dragon and a drow rider— was it Tiago, might be right outside. But so too were his friends, out there with a dragon and the deadly drow. With a low growl, Drizzt tore fully free of the wall and spun, whipping his cloak around so that it cracked into the stone, freeing it of some of the heavy ice. Out to the rock went Drizzt, tall Maril in hand, ready to strike again at the dragon and its Baenri rider. But the worm was not to be seen. Drizzt spotted Catti Bree and Brunner below, and how their faces lit up as they waved to their dear friend. They ran off to the north, motioning for Drizzt to join them. And Drizzt did, with his bow in hand. From this high vantage he could strike behind the front ranks, where battle had been joined. From this high perch the giants would be easy targets indeed. And from this high perch he could watch for the return of the dragon. Goblins and orcs spun up and out to the side like water flying from the sharp prow of a fast-moving ship as Athrogate and his spinning morning stars plowed into the line. With abandon, with fury, with the strength of a giant and a pair of magical weapons as powerful as anything on the field, the black-bearded dwarf howled with glee, accepting hits and dealing devastating blows in return. To the other dwarves, ferocious in their own right, this one seemed completely unafraid, even welcoming of death, and so it was true. Athrogate, once of Felbar, too long a wanderer, cursed and unable to die, didn't care. This seemed to him his time and his place, and as soon as he got through the fodder goblinkin, and he had already turned this end of the line, he intended on making straight for the handful of frost giants behind them. They'd kill him to death, he figured. But he didn't care. The rest of the boys would get back into Mithril Hall, and his name would be sung by the Skalds. And when King Emerus learned the truth of Athrogate, who had been banished from Felbar, Athrogate would have his proper revenge. He flinched as he sent one broken goblin flying off to the side. A shot of lightning, it seemed, crackled just above him. In the distance he saw a giant lurch, then again, and then another, as a line of lightning arrows flew in at them. Athrogate managed a moment to glance back, to see Drizzt up on high, that killing bow in hand.
"Bwaha!"
he roared, suddenly figuring that he'd not only be a hero, but live to brag about it, too.
"Turn the damned line!" he heard Brunner's voice above the shouts and clatter of battle. "Bend her in! To the hall, boys! To the hall!
Bwa-ha-ha! Athrogate roared all the louder. Benjer Bodrow into the hall! I'll send him flying with me balls!
Hold! Came Brunner's roar behind him, aimed right for him, and Athrogate skidded to a stop.
Save some for meself, ye dolt! Brunner cried, sliding up beside him and cracking his axe against his shield to emphasize the point.
Bwa-ha-ha! Athrogate roared.
Brunner pulled him to the left and away from the rocky outcropping. More arrows stabbed into the giants, and now their attention was fully on the drow and that nasty bow, boulder after boulder spinning out at the ridge.
Brunner chopped down an orc and shield-rushed a second, driving it back and, more importantly, driving himself ahead, Athrogate beside him.
Right behind them, tickling their behinds, came a wall of fire from Catti Bri, sealing the eastern flank of the battle line. And out of that wall of fire stepped a huge elemental beast from the fiery plain, rushing straight out at the behemoths, with goblins and orcs fleeing in terror before it. Side by side, the two dwarves plowed through the ranks, sweeping the line and freeing up dwarves with every step.
"To the hall!" Brunner yelled repeatedly, instructing those dwarves freed from battle to run straight out, and those still tight against the goblins to fight a retreating action.
So they collapsed around the tunnel entrance, dwarves scooping shields and sliding back down the slope. Out in the east, the giants stumbled away, arrows biting at them, the fire elemental biting at them, and now with Gwenivar biting at them too.
"Ye go in, King Brunner, and get your girl with ye," Athrogate offered. "I'll hold the last of the dogs."
"Nah," Brunner replied. "Got me a better idea." And he lifted his cracked silver horn to his lips and blew a cracking note.
"The Puent'll hold 'em."
"Come on, girl," Brunner called to Catti Bri as the time neared for he and Athrogate to get inside. Catti Bri nodded and launched one last fireball at a mob of orcs who looked as if they might be regrouping for another charge. She rushed for the tunnel, glancing back at Drizzt, as was Brunner. Drizzt waved at them to continue and smiled confidently. Catti Bri picked up a great shield and set it down at the tunnel lip, falling atop it. Somehow this seemed to her far scarier than staying out there to battle the orcs, or even the giants, or even the damned dragon. But she felt Brunner's hand on her back and heard Athrogate's laugh, and it wasn't her choice as the red-bearded dwarf shoved her into the tunnel for a wild and bouncing ride down the steep decline. She figured out what those curving beams had been for as she neared the bottom in the torchlight. The dwarves had turned this slide into a jump. She heard herself screaming as she felt herself flying. She hit the water with a great splash, the cold liquid grabbing at her. But so too were dwarven hands, catching her around the shoulders and hauling her out, then unceremoniously launching her in a slide across the ice, around the hole they'd chopped to the far bank where other dwarves, clerics with heavy blankets, waited with a large fire burning in the corner behind them. Catti Bri managed to glance back when she heard Brunner's howl and saw the dwarf high in the air, arms flapping like the wings of a broken bird. Right behind him came Athrogate, morning stars spinning. Dwarves hauled them out and sent them skidding across the ice.
"Close the damned tunnel," went the shouts.
"Not yet," Brunner, Athrogate, and Catti Bri all yelled together, and sure enough, a moment later came the last shield, one carrying a dark elf, skidding down the ramp, catching the curve of the jump, and flying gracefully above the pond.
"Take a bath, elf!" Brunner howled.
But Drizzt didn't. The shield splashed into the water, and Drizzt gracefully rolled upright in his descent before coming down atop it, stepping and leaping so quickly that he barely got his boots wet before settling down on the solid ice.
"Darned elf," a drenched Brunner grumbled. "Bwa-ha-ha," howled the equally dripping Athrogate.
"Curse the gods, I had him," Tiago fumed. He was back in Nesme. Sarabel tended his broken leg with Tosin and Doomwheel nearby.
"You got your sword back," Sarabel replied dryly, her tone making it quite clear that she was less than thrilled with Tiago.
"Orothiter is quite angry," said Ravel, coming into the room.
Sarabel glared at Tiago.
"Would it have not better served us all, and Matron Mother Quenthel most of all,
if you had come to us with your plan to lure the dwarves out of their hole?"
Tosin dared to ask.
"You knew," Tiago replied. "I made no secret." "You did not say when it would transpire," Tosin interrupted, apparently feeling quite brave.
Tiago noticed then that his wife, the high priestess of House Beenri, nodded approvingly at the upstart Armgo noble. This interrogation had been practiced.
"Arothater will return to his lair in the spine of the world, into the month of Hammer at least," Ravel announced.
"Driz Doerden is dead," Tiago growled.
"You returned to the spot," Tosin argued. "He was not there.
Cut out of the dragon's ice by the retreating dwarves.
The orcs saw Driz retreat into Mithril Hall. They are orcs, they know nothing,"
Tiago insisted, hoping beyond reason.
"Enough,"
Sarabel quietly ordered them all.
"It was a good attempt, and the prize would have been great indeed," she said to her husband. "But yes, you should have allowed all of us to partake in the attempt at defeating the rogue, Doerden. You put your personal pride above the good of Menzo Berenzon." Tiago could hardly believe what he was hearing from these companions. He was Tiago Beenri, grandson of mighty Dantrag, favored great-nephew of matron mother Quenthel Beenri. They were, what, cast-off Zor Lorenz, a long-forgotten Armgo, and a half-breed not worthy to even be in this room. He pulled himself to a sitting position and glared at all of them in turn. "Who leads this expedition?" he asked.
"Matron Mother Quenthel," Sarabel answered without the slightest hesitation.
"She is not here," said Tiago. "Nor is Gromf, nor any other matron mother, nor any ranking Zor Lauren."
"You are the weapons master of House Doerden," Ravel reminded him. "I am the house wizard. We are of equal rank."
"I am Beenri, and our house is in Menzo Berenzon, created by the great matron mother Beenri," Tiago reminded.
"As I am Beenri, husband," said Sarabel, "and high priestess of House Doerden, second only to matron mother Darthir herself." She paused and snickered and reiterated, "Matron mother Darthir," with a dismissive chortle.
Tiago stared at her hard, wondering how greatly Matron Mother Quenthel would punish him when she discovered that he had disemboweled the witch named Sarabel.
"Are you claiming leadership over the Drow and the Silver Marches?" Tiago asked incredulously, a feeling he was clearly not trying to hide.
"I am," Sarabel said without hesitation, and she looked to Ravel and Tosin, and both, to Tiago's utter amazement, nodded in agreement. Tiago started to argue, but Sarabel cut him short.
"We are not long for the surface," she explained. "Almost all of our kin are in the tunnels about the dwarven citadels now, or guarding the underground ways to the city called Silvery Moon, sealing our enemies in place. We will starve the dwarves this winter to force them out into open battle, but you and I will not likely see that fight, husband. For Matron Mother Darthir calls, and House Doerden awaits."
"You cannot be serious," Tiago argued. "Drizzt is in there, in Mithril Hall. They will come out. He—"
"You said he was dead," Sarabel reminded. "So when we return to Menzo Berenzon, claim yourself as the killer of the rogue Doerden."
"And pray that he never shows himself again," Tiago thought, but did not say. For such a humiliation as that would finish his ambitions in Menzo Berenzon.
"Rest, husband," said Sarabel.
And she rose and started away, the others collecting in her wake, except for Ravel, who remained behind.
"I had him,"
Tiago said when he was alone with his wizard friend.
"Had you returned with his head, it might have gone better for you," said Ravel.
"What do you mean?
What do you know?" Tiago demanded. "And pray tell me where Sarabel has found such courage."
"Your answers are all one and the same," said Ravel. "When I went to Arothater after your return,
Grump Banry was waiting, and he was not amused. Tiago sucked in his breath, and he grew less amused as the dragon revealed its own great displeasure, said Revel. It is a tenuous alliance we hold with the two white dragons, my friend, and one clearly very important to Gromph. And it quickly became clear to me that Drizdo Erden is not important to Orothitor or to Gromph.
So Sarabel acts with the imprimatur of the Archmage
and of the Matron Mother.
It makes no sense,
Tiago said, shaking his head. Drizdo Erden is in there. The greatest prize of all is within our reach. Why would they not see that? The greatest prize to you, said Revel.
Why are we housed to Erden?
There was a vacancy on the ruling council the Matron Mother wished to fill with a Baenri-dominated house. It was a brilliant move, you must admit. With House Zor Lauren moving out, there seemed to be a struggle impending between Baenri and Barrison Delarmgo. But now Matron Mother Quenthal dominates the ruling council too completely for any to connive against her.
But why to Erden? Tiago pressed.
An empty a cursed house, Tiago interrupted. And one resurrected now for one reason only. To humiliate the avowed enemy of Lolth.
And why not kill him?
Revel shrugged and shook his head. They will, likely, he answered. But in the Matron Mother's own time. Matron Mother Quenthal is being very conservative and cautious. She remembers the fate of her mother, whose head was cleaved in half by King Brunner. We have attacked 7 major strongholds, Tiago, not even including this worthless town you now claim as Duke. 7 major strongholds. War with Silvery Moon alone would bring great struggle to Menzo Berenzon if the claims of that city's wizardly powers are not exaggerated.
Tiago shook his head, having none of it.
7, Revel repeated, and he recited them slowly for emphasis. Citadel Adbar, Citadel Felbar, Mithril Hall, Sundabar, Silvery Moon, Everlund, and the Elves of the Glimmerwood. The orcs, the giants, and the dragons, particularly the dragons, make this possible.
He ended there and shrugged again, then started away with his unspoken conclusion hanging in Tiago's thoughts. Tiago had risked Orothitor for his personal desire to kill Drizzt. Gromph and the Matron Mother had gone to great lengths to enlist the dragons, so said the whispers. Tiago flung a pillow across the room and crossed his arms over his chest, sneering. And plotting. Drizzt was in that dwarven hole, and despite his claims, Tiago did not believe for a moment that the rogue drow was dead.
But he will be, Tiago whispered, and I will carry his head into Menzo Berenzon.
Winter settled deep around the silver marches, and hammers rang in the dwarven halls. But so too did bellies rumble, particularly in Citadel Felbar, and more particularly in Citadel Adbar, whose lifeblood was trade and whose trade had been halted. Winter settled deep around the vast orc encampments, but with the granaries of Hartusk Keep at their disposal, the hardy orcs were not dismayed. Believered Silvery Moon welcomed the respite, her vast legion of wizards and priests more than able to feed the populace. In the south, the mighty city of Everlund crouched, hushed, knowing that doom was not far, knowing that the snows would recede and the orc horde would come on. The snows piled. The cold wind blew strong that year, as 1484 turned to 1485, in the winter of the Iron Dwarf.